Got it. All right, let me give a couple of disclaimers early on, and then I want to talk to you more in the next hour when we'll have a little more flexibility and time. Really glad to have, if you haven't met Jeff and Shirley Waltmeyer, they're members of our congregation at Henderson Boulevard. The church at Henderson always sends scouts out with me to make sure I preach the truth there, and Jeff and Shirley are here to take notes today to make sure I don't say anything wrong. No, they're up here vacationing. Shirley has a family in the area, and so I'm so glad they were able to be here, and it was kind of coincidental that I would be here on the same Sunday they are. If you haven't met them, they're wonderful people, great servants of the Lord. And I'm looking forward to meeting you. I've heard good things about you, and I've gotten to meet Nathan in the preacher's workshop, and I'm looking forward to spending time with him also. But in this particular hour, we got to put on running shoes and get moving. So I'm going to ask you to follow along with me. You may have those worksheets. If you do, you don't have to turn those back in to me. That's just something for you to follow along with and maybe to have for future reference. In the Q&As, it may be somebody asks a question, and I won't answer that at the time because I'll say we're going to get into that more later. But we'll try to limit the Q&As to the areas where we're talking about in each of these particular situations. So, there are some things that are relative. They're not absolutes. I would not say broccoli is incredible. That would be an absolute. I would say broccoli is good if you compare it to Brussels sprouts. You know, so it's a relative thing. Liver is good compared to, no, there's nothing. That's an absolute bad. There's nothing you can compare that to. So as we look at the qualifications from 1 Timothy chapter 3 and Titus chapter 1, that's where we're going to be this morning. We're almost going to spend all of our time there. Are those qualifications meant to be absolutes, or are they relative? And the answer is yes. They are both. What I mean by that is the men who serve as leaders in a congregation are to be elders. But how old does one have to be an elder? And I think we need to realize that's an absolute. He has to be older, but that older is a relative term. We have in Florida, and you may have heard of it, one of the fastest growing areas in Florida is a place called The Villages. And it is eating up Central Florida. It is just expanding at an incredible rate. It is a retirement village. Everybody drives golf carts there. I would say to be an elder in the Villages is probably different than being an elder at Henderson Boulevard. Because in the Villages, everybody's an elder. And so it might be that a person who, under other circumstances, would be considered older in the Villages might be a whippersnapper, a kid. So that's a relative thing. But there's one thing that's certain. They must be, by some definition, older. They can't be 20 years old. Now, I want to show you, as we look at today, God's leaders and what they are like. We're looking at the particular qualifications. And I want to say this up front. The qualities of leaders, which are unique to them, are pretty limited. And what I mean by that is almost all the things that shepherds slash elders slash overseers slash pastors slash bishops slash presbyters, those are all terms used of God's leaders. And you're going to probably hear me using shepherd more than elders. We'll talk about that in the next hour.
But the qualifications or qualities of those men, with only a few exceptions, are the qualities God expects of all of His people. All of them. So when you say, well, an elder is to be hospitable, if you're thinking in terms different than members are to be hospitable, you're putting a qualification on those shepherds that the Bible hasn't put, that's different than what it puts on you. Or that he is to be just, or that he is to be devoted, devout. All of those are qualities he says you ought to have. So I think we need to be really careful that we don't put the bar too high on those who are leaders and say, no, they have to be a different kind of devout or hospitable or just or pure than we are. Here are the only qualifications that are peculiar to shepherds. Number one, he has to be a male. Women cannot be shepherds. So women can be Christians, men can be Christians, are called upon to be, men and women, but shepherds must be male. And along the same lines, they have to be married. So there are married male and they are fathers. All of these are peculiar in that doesn't mean others aren't that, but you don't have to be those things to be a Christian. You don't have to be a Christian, but you have to be those things to be a shepherd. He has to manage his household well. That's another one that's not called upon by every Christian, and he has to desire the office of an elder. Every Christian is not called upon to desire the office of an elder. And finally, he can't be a novice, and he has to be able to teach. And those kind of go together. We'll talk about that as we move through these qualities. So again, as we begin this, every overseer is to possess every quality. I'm not going to give you some qualities and you're able to say, well, Brother A isn't that, but he is most of these other things, but he's not that at all. This is not a matter of having the majority of these qualities. He has to possess some aspect of every one of these qualities. But we also need to understand that not all of us possess those qualities to the same degree. So, as an example, let's go back to hospitality. All of us are called upon to be hospitable to strangers. All of us. But some of us are a little more hospitable than others. For some of us, hospitality is welcoming them when they come in the door and smiling and making them feel welcome. That's hospitality. I grant that. Others of us kind of go out of our way. We want to invite them to go out and eat with us after services are over, or we want to have them in our homes, or we have parties in our homes all the time. Others go even further. They adopt everybody that comes through the door and puts them in their will. You know? So there are degrees of hospitality, but you must be hospitable. And one more thing. You don't look at the eldership as a group and say, well, Brother A is not hospitable, but Brother B really is. So it kind of makes up for it. Every shepherd has to possess all the qualities, but the degree to which they possess those may vary. One man may be an amazing Bible class teacher. And when you think of apt to teach, that's the first person you think of. Another may not be really a great teacher, but if the teacher wasn't there, he'd step up and do something. He'd at least make a stab at it and is capable of presenting the truth, but maybe not in the same way the other brother is. Okay. You can hone your skills as a bishop or a shepherd,
but you cannot find those skills after your appointment. Did that make sense? So as you're thinking about leaders in this congregation, you can't say, well, Brother C isn't really able to teach, but I'll bet after he's appointed an elder, he'll develop that. You can't think in those terms. These are qualities they must possess before they are appointed to that work. So let's go through. First of all, I'm going to group the qualifications. Timothy and Titus didn't do that, but they're not as OCD as I am. And so they kind of scattered them all around. But I'm going to group them because I think it may help you if you group those together also. I'm joking. They did not make a mistake in the way they did that. But I think it helps us if we can kind of group them together. And it'll also help us in the interest of time to kind of group them. So let's first look at the qualifications or qualities of an overseer regarding his home life. And the first is, he must be the husband of one wife. Before we get into that, there were two more things I wanted to say that I briefly said in the opening, and the other I haven't said yet. He must be a man. I will tell you, even though there are churches of various flavors that are starting to say, well, I think a woman could be a shepherd, that is not at all in any way, shape, or form allowable by the scriptures. There is no way. And you can't get away with it by having a woman who says, I identify as a man. You can't do that. It does not work in God's plan to make that kind of thing happen. So it must be a man. And the second preliminary statement that I want to make is, he must desire the work. Desire the work. Now, you need to understand, the Bible uses varying degree words. Some words are stronger than others. This is a really strong word. If any man desires the office of a bishop or overseer, he desires a good thing. 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 1 says, this word for desire is the exact same word for lust. For lust. Now, when you think of lust, two things. Number one, you always think of it as a bad thing. I do too. I do too. If I said I have a strong desire for my wife, you would think of that in different terms than you would if I said I lust for my wife. We tend to make that a pure sexual thing. But the Bible doesn't really do that. So you can have a strong desire, called a lust in some cases, for good things. You can lust for righteousness. We don't like to use that word that way because we have a bad connotation for that term. But it's the exact same term. So here's the point. A man is not qualified to be a shepherd who talks this way. Well, I mean, if the congregation wants me to serve, if they do, and we need a person, we need another person, well, I'll do it. There isn't a single thing in my wording, my inflection, or my physical representation that indicated lust or strong desire. Not a thing. That was one of these, well, if you nominate me, I'll run, and if you elect me, I'll serve. But I don't really want that. He must desire the work. Now, I know that could run to excess, and he could have this passion for ruling that we'll talk about that's not allowed. But he has to have a strong desire to serve, and he needs to make that known. That needs to be known by the congregation. That yes, I want to serve God's people in this way. Not I want power. Not that. But I want to serve because that's a great way I can serve God's people and serve my God. Yes, I want that in my life. All right. Now, having said that, We look at his home life because this is the most visible aspect or representation of a man's ability to rule or guide. When we use the word rule, we're not trying to use a word for autocratic dictatorship, but to manage or oversee a household. How he oversees his household is probably a great indicator and a barometer measurement of how he will be as a ruler of God's people. So his home life must be under the microscope and examined very carefully, because the home is going to be the mirror of his managerial and interpersonal skills. He must be the husband of one wife. Now, we can talk about it more if somebody wants to bring it up in the Q&A. But I want to tell you, literally, when you see the literal translation of this word, it solves it for me. It means literally one woman man. That's what it means. He is a one woman man. And we don't typically have a problem with it if we say, well, we've got this one guy and he's got three wives. We don't typically have that issue in our churches. But there were churches that did have that kind of issue. They had people that had been involved in polygamous relationships, and if that were the case in a church, that man couldn't serve. He's not a one-woman man. He may say, I have a favorite among the women, but that's not what we're talking about here. He is a one-woman man. Where we tend to have that issue is in two cases: a divorce or a death of a spouse and a remarriage. So, is a man who's has a legitimate reason for divorce, he was either divorced by his spouse or he divorced his spouse for scriptural reasons and married again, how many wives does he have? Does he have? He is a one woman man. He wouldn't claim both women on his income tax forms. And if you ask him, tell me who your wife is, he wouldn't say which one. He is a one-woman man. If his spouse dies and he remarries, how many spouses does he have? He has one. He has one. He may talk about his former wife and talk about her before she passed in glowing terms. He may talk about the fact that he still loves her. But he wouldn't say, I have two wives. He wouldn't say that. He would say, I have one wife. Meet my wife. Not one of my wives, my wife. That's the way we would talk. Now, it seems to me that that's a pretty clear indicator of what that means. It does not say he has been married only once. That's not what it says. It says he's a one-woman man. We can talk about it more if you'd like, but that's all I really have to say about that one. Secondly, he must manage or rule his own household well. 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 4. Why is that important? Well, because if you can't take care of a small group like a household, how can he take care of a large group of saints and answer to God for all of them? And taking on the responsibility for people of all different flavors. They're not just those who live in his household. They're people that have come from other places. Some are older than he is. Some are different in background than he is. How can he do that if he can't even manage his own household well? Now, that doesn't mean because he manages his household well, he can manage 100 people well. That's not true, but I'll guarantee you this. I'm going to guarantee you this. If he can't manage a household of 4 or 6 or 10, he will fail miserably in trying to manage a household of 60, 80, or 100. He'll fail. So you need to look at the life of the man. Does he manage his household well. And part of that has to do with his children. Let's talk about that. Having children who are faithful or who believe. Children. Is children plural? Yes. Is children singular? Yes. If I asked the question this morning, if I had not begun with this, if I had just said, by the way, before we get into this, how many of you have children? If some of you have only one child, you'd raise your hand. You wouldn't keep your hand down. You know, he didn't say, child, don't put your hand up, honey. He did not say, do you have a child? He said, children. And that's not us. When you fill out a form for a job or taxes, it says, children. How many? You wouldn't say, I can't fill that in because I only have one. You know that one child is included in the statement, children. We use that term that way. But you may say, yeah, but Ralph, we're looking at biblical terms. Does the Bible use it that way? It absolutely does. Children is a generalizing term, and it includes or means one or more. In Ephesians chapter 6, verse 1 and verse 4, it says, children, obey your parents in the Lord. A single child wouldn't say, that's not me. I don't want to do that. I'm an only child. I'm a child. It doesn't say child, obey or honor your parents. It says children. And then in verse 4, fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath or to anger. A father of one child wouldn't say, that's not to me. It didn't say child, it said children. I have a child. I don't have children. You and I would say, oh, you're playing with words. You're playing with words. Let me give you one more in the Old Testament. In Genesis chapter 21, you need to mark this mentally. In Genesis chapter 21, verses 5 through 7, when Sarah and Abraham are talking about the promise God gave that she would bear a child, and that's all, she only bore one child. She says about that something, I'm paraphrasing it here, she says something along these lines, and who would imagine that I would give children to nurse? Children. She uses the term that's generalized, even though it's very clear God only promised her one and she only had one, but she talks about it in terms of children. So if Sarah were in the audience this morning, I guarantee you, based on scripture, if I said, if you have children, raise your hand, Sarah would raise her hand. So when it says he has believing children, I think we're making too much of the word and not as it is used biblically to say, no, it's got to be more than one. And I know the argument. I know the practicality. Somebody says, well, a person who has only one child, that person doesn't understand what it's like to have multiple children and how different they can be. Well, if I use that same argument, I could draw a conclusion that a man shouldn't be an elder if he doesn't have 10 kids. Because he certainly is more experienced in a variety of personalities than the person who has two. But I don't have a right to make that decision as to what constitutes children. I understand what the argument is, and I will argue against that a man who has multiple children certainly has more experience in dealing with a variety of personalities and circumstances and challenges than a man who has one child. I grant that, but that doesn't mean the man who has one child isn't qualified. The qualification in the scriptures is he has to be a man who has children, and those children have to be under control and in subjection. 1 Timothy chapter 3, verses 4 and 5. It says, with all dignity, or with all respectfulness. And that isn't as much a reference to the children as it is to the man himself. That he manages his household with dignity, with respectfulness, that he has them under his control with gravity. I mean, we have all seen people who are trying to manage children, and they're just making a spectacle of themselves the way they're trying to do that. We would not say, I saw the most respectable person the other day in the grocery store. It was a woman, and her children were running up and down the aisles. And she was reacting this way. You get over here! You get here right now! I'm telling you, if I have to come after you, you made me have to come after you. I'll do it. I mean it. I'll do it. I brought you into this world. I can take you out of it. If they're screaming and yelling and running after and making a spectacle, none of us would say, that's pretty respectable. That was grave. That was done well. That was good management skills. We wouldn't say that. So this is a reference more to how he manages than how the children respond to the management that he is demonstrating. They are children not accused of dissipation or riot, Titus says, chapter 1, verse 6. They are not unruly. They are not out of subjection. They are not insubordinate. They are not out of control. These are the qualifications of the children. And then one more, Titus chapter 1 verse 6 tells us they must be children who believe or who are faithful. And I want to talk about that because that's very important. If a man is above reproach, Titus 1 6, the husband of one wife having children who believe. All right, now first of all, again, we're not talking about necessarily multiples. A child is children. Children who believe is really the statement, literally, full of faith or faithful. It's the same term that is found in Acts chapter 16 and verse 15, where it says of Lydia, she said to Saul, if you have judged me to be faithful to the Lord, come into my house and stay. I want to make two statements about that before we move on. Number one, it is not faithful to the parents. That's not what's under consideration here. My kids are small. They're not old enough to be Christians yet, but they're faithful to what I tell them to do. Am I qualified to be a shepherd? No. The word faithful is not used in that term in the New Testament. Faithful to the parent. The faithfulness is to the Lord. It is to God. It is to Jesus Christ. And it is only used of Christians after the Gospels. Only used of Christians after the four Gospels. It never again is it used, unless it's here, never again is it used of people who just are faithful to their parents or just tend to be loyal. That's not what's under consideration. But must his children remain faithful to his faith all their lives? And must all of them remain faithful all their lives? And I want to ask this so that we can explore this. I understand and appreciate people who say, well, I think they must be. They have to be Christians all their lives. And that's certainly what we all would want. But is that required of a shepherd? And typically, the reason we say that is required is because if that's not true, there's some flaw in what he did in rearing them. He didn't do the job he should have done, or they would have been faithful. And we sometimes cite Proverbs chapter 22, verse 6, if you train up a child in the way he should go, when he's old, he won't depart from it. But Proverbs chapter 22, verse 23 says, when somebody steals, God will kill them or bring them to judgment. Is that always true? Or are those general truths? We typically say of the Proverbs, they're generally true. They're not always true. If we argue that if a child doesn't remain faithful to his parents' or her parents' teachings, then there was a flaw in the way they were taught, you have to deal with God and his children. Are all of God's children faithful till death? You know in this congregation, as I know in my own, that hasn't been true. Well, is that God's fault? God desires that for them. Did he fail in implementing his will in their lives? Or is there an element of free will that we exercise in some of us to our detriment eternally? And if that's true for us, then our children may reach a point at which they abandon the faith of their father or mother. Are the parents responsible for that? Is that father still managing a household when his child marries and goes off and has their own home? Are they still under his oversight? Is he still responsible for their welfare? I know he wants to be an influence. I'm not arguing that. But I'm arguing, is he responsible if they go in a direction he doesn't want them to go? Is he at fault? And if you say, well, I think he is because he's the primary leader, then wrestle with Isaiah chapter 1, verse 2, where God talks about his children going astray. I'll tell you what I'm going to offer. And again, we can talk about this. How an elder deals with unfaithful children who leave his faith is much more important to me than whether they all are faithful or not. Does he go after them? Has he just shrugged his shoulders and said, well, they make their own choice. They make their bed, they lie in it. Has he gone after them? Has he stood on the front porch like the father in Luke chapter 15 or the shepherd in Luke chapter 15? One who is constantly waiting for his child to come home, agonizing over it, and then running to meet them when they come? Or the shepherd who says, wait, I'm missing a sheep. Oh, well, that happens. I got 99 still. We'll let the other one go. What does he do? He goes after them. Look at the men who have unfaithful children. Are they going after them? Are they shedding tears? Are they sorrowful? That's the real test. I'll tell you why. Because if they'll go after their own kids that way, if I go astray, they're coming after me. That's the kind of shepherd I want. That's the kind of leader I want. One who cares about my state. He has to be hospitable. 1 Timothy 3, verse 2. This means generous to strangers, guests. It may involve food. It may involve keeping people. It may involve sharing what you have with others. It doesn't have to. There's nothing in the word itself except you are generous to strangers. And that's going to vary. That varies in different parts of the country. I lived in Mississippi for 5 years. And when we first moved there, my wife and I, we were urban people, both of us. And we moved to a very rural place in Cleveland, Mississippi. And the first couple of times we went to visit with people, we'd be there and we'd be at their house. And then we would stand up and say, well, it's time for us to go. We better go. They go, what's your hurry? And I thought, well, I guess nothing. And I'd sit back down. And I didn't realize that's just an expression. That really doesn't mean stay a while. It's just an expression. You know, what's your hurry? I learned after a while, you know, that's really what it means. And that it was just a way of saying we've enjoyed having you and that time's gone quickly. But it doesn't mean sit down and stay for another couple of hours. We define hospitality in different ways in different places. But they must be hospitable. And they have to be financially sound. Free from the love of money. 1 Timothy 3:3 says. That means not greedy. Not fond of sordid gain. Titus 1 verse 7. Earthy, base, material gain and wealth. He's not willing to obtain money by questionable means. He treats money as it ought to be treated, as just a commodity for serving others. All right, let's look at his reputation. We'll go through this one very quickly. He is to be above reproach. 1 Timothy 3:2. King James Version says blameless, but it really means not he's never done anything wrong, but that there's no lingering wrong in his life. He has impeccable character. His life can't be spoken against. People consider him to be respectable, 1 Timothy 3:2. He is modest. He doesn't cause trouble. He's agreeing to and abiding by the principles of the community in which he lives. And he has a good reputation with those outside the church. I think it's important in considering shepherds that you perhaps interact with people who interact with your potential shepherds on a daily basis. What do employees think of their employer? What does the employer think of his employee? What do clients or customers think of this particular person? Does this person have a good standing with those who are outside testimony or report? And then there is his character, what he is. He is first temperate. That word simply means self-control. I know we have tended to restrict that to temperance, which has to do with alcohol. That one will come up. But temperate simply means he's an even temper. He's not extreme, volatile, nor is he almost non-existent. The only way you know he's alive is he's breathing. He's temperate. He's in the middle of those two extremes. And he is prudent, which means sober-minded. He curbs his desires. He is thoughtful. He's sensible. He's discreet. And that is the next word, sensible, self-restrained. It is this word for sensible. It is the exact opposite of the term being intoxicated. It's the exact opposite of that term. So when you think of somebody who's intoxicated, they're not sensible. They're not behaving properly. They are frivolous. They are light, or they are extreme. This man is not that, and he is gentle. Yielding, kind, fair, moderate, patient with people. Let's look at what he is. He is just, he is righteous, upright. He conforms to the laws of God and man, and he is devout, which simply means pleasing to God. It's a word for holy in the King James Version. Now, I know I went through those quickly, but we can talk about it more if we need to. What is he not? We've looked at what he is. What is he not? He is not addicted to wine. Both Timothy and Titus mentioned this. That doesn't mean that was more important than other things that were said, but it certainly is important that he not be addicted. I think we would add today, also not addicted to painkillers, not addicted to illegal drugs, not addicted to anything that he can't control, but that controls him. That's important. It seems, because it's part of his ability to control himself. And if he can control himself, hopefully he can help control others and manage that. He is not to be quick-tempered, soon angry, prone to, the King James said, prone to anger. This also goes along with the fact that he is not to be pugnacious or contentious. Again, in Mississippi, they had an expression. Somebody would say of a guy, you know, you don't want to mess with him. He's bad to fight. Bad to fight. I mean, everybody understands that. He's quick with his words and ready to be contentious. An elder can't be that. And I'll tell you why he can't. He can't be that because that demonstrates lack of control of himself. And the other thing is he's not self-willed. He can't constantly be saying, my way or the highway. Shepherds, individually or as a group, who say, my way or the highway, will find the sheep on the highway. Trust me, I know the sheep will leave because they are here voluntarily. You may be able to say that as a boss of a company because you control the person's time card and their pay scale and the work they do. You might pound the table and say, you do it my way or you can leave. They may not have much choice. God's people have choice. And you can't be self-willed. And you need to also remember that a shepherd is a member of a bishopric. That's a group of elders. A group of shepherds. He doesn't rule by himself. So he can't be self-willed because he can't be that in the eldership. He's got to work with others. And all of these are indications of his ability to work with others. A man who can't work with others, a man who is constantly saying, no, it's this way or it's no way. If he's constantly doing that about things that he has opinions about, he's not going to work well in a congregational setting. Finally, his relation to the word, and we'll close. He is not to be a new convert. The King James Version says not a novice, but we understand that. In 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 6, Paul says, I planted. And that word for planting is the word for this, is the same word used here. In other words, Paul says, I planted seeds. That's new plants. That's new. He can't be a novice. He's not to be a new Christian. Now again, what is a novice? It's an absolute, but it's also relative. If a new congregation forms and nobody's been a Christian more than 5 years, they may decide somebody who's been there 5 years isn't a novice anymore. That's up to the congregation to make those kinds of decisions in situations like that. But he's not to be a new convert. Why? Partly because he's got to be able to teach. King James has said apt to teach. And apt is a word that some of us use as not just capable but desiring. We use that word. He's apt to get mad if you say that. That means he's liable to. He's predisposed to. That's not what this word means. This doesn't mean he jumps in wanting to teach all the time, but that he is capable of teaching. He's skillful. He's a good teacher of the word of God. And he loves what is good. The King James said lover of good men, but men's not in the text. He's a lover of good. That seems self-explanatory. And he holds fast the faithful word. He clings to it. Clings to the word. He loves the word. He wants to hear the word. He wants to give the word. That doesn't mean he doesn't talk about sports or hunting or fishing or other hobbies or politics or people or movies or books or music. It doesn't mean he doesn't talk about those things. But his predisposition is to things of God. He holds fast the faithful word. Why? He needs to be able to refute those who teach false doctrine. He needs to bring to light those who contradict and oppose the truth. Well, we went a little bit over, but we're done with this lesson. I'm going to close with a quick prayer, and then we'll stand adjourned for a few moments. Join me. Lord, I pray we've been true to the text and to your will. I know saying that doesn't make it so. But Lord, if there is more about your will you would have us know, show us. Either in the collective wisdom of this body, or show us in text we haven't considered, or in the very words that we have been considering. Because what matters more than anything is not what our opinions are or what our desires are, except the desire to do your will and yours only, to speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Guide us through this series of studies, Lord. We need your help and we need your guidance and we need your will to be done in all things. Please hear us in the name of Jesus, our Lord, the chief shepherd. Amen.